Well, my good friend Al Danzig greeted me today by saying, well, I guess we're going to hear an old one, since he's heard about 30 of my Easter sermons. It is one of the great challenges of clergy of all faiths to find new ways of talking about old, ancient, and recurring themes and subjects. That calendar just keeps coming around, and there are times when clergy get desperate. They want to kind of have the choir do a Sondheim Little Christmas, and they want to do modern dance for Easter, and just find some new way of dealing with the old material. Well, I want to deal with the old material with considerable respect today. I have been seriously thinking about the Exodus and what that means, and Easter and what that means, not simply on the surface story level. Is it factual? Is it not factual? Probably little of either story is factual. I want to talk about it in terms of what is universal in the human experience and how these stories and these sagas of all faiths tell very similar stories and reveal, whatever the facts, very similar universal human truths. I want to deal with two laws that I call Dober's first law of religion and Dober's second law of religion. I've named them after Dober. The first law is anything that you find in one religion, you will find somewhere in every religion. Sometimes vestigial, sometimes not recognized, but it happens. You can find an analog. The second law is to remember that the people who wrote the ancient stories, whether from Norse mythology, American Indian stories, Indian stories, Greek stories, ancient Hebrew stories, Sumerian stories, were not dumber than we are. They were bright, sophisticated, subtle. They knew what metaphor was. They knew how to code things, not in the biblical code of numbers and prophecy, but how to tell three or four stories in the same story. Many of you know that this season is a season of birth, death, rebirth, renewal. It is the life cycle. It is spring, summer, autumn, fall, all rolled up into Palm Sunday, Passover, and Easter. And many of you also know that I have been writing the cycle of life, and it has been spinning faster than my legs can pedal with the death of my mother and with the birth of my granddaughter, my exceptional, unusual granddaughter, who already has 1,500 on her SATs. That's the nature of granddaughters, by the way, as well as grandsons. And that's part of the life cycle that we all ride. And for me, it's just come in a very compressed time. But it's a universal story. What I have gone through, everyone goes through, which is loss and birth, hope, despair, tears, laughter, joy, all different ways that we let go and then keep going. It struck me somewhat, the great advantage of commuting sometimes 40 minutes if there's no traffic and no police, and sometimes an hour and 45 minutes if it was yesterday, is that it gives you a lot of time to think about important stuff. And I was rolling around in my head what the Exodus had in common with the Odyssey and had in common with the Easter story. It strikes me that the Odyssey is not simply the story of Odysseus wandering from Ithaca to the Trojan Wars, and then, like Moses, not asking directions and not being able to find home for a good long time. But it's the story of every man, and in some ways, every woman, though it being ancient Greek, it was written from a male viewpoint. And it recapitulates a life and the way that we tend to develop and the phases that we go through as human beings. Here's Odysseus, a princeling in Ithaca, who leaves his wife and family for the great adventure of war and the honor of his larger nation. That war being successfully prosecuted, he starts wandering around. And what does he encounter? He encounters what young people encounter. First of all, going off to war, their invincibility and those ideas of nobility and being involved in this great process of war, of honor, of conquest, not understanding the price that he will pay even if he survives. Then he goes through phases that most human beings go through. He meets the Cyclops. And what is a Cyclops? It's a one-eyed being that has no perspective. It's monomania. It can't get the depth. It only has the focus. And it doesn't see the rest of the world. That sounds like so many people I know and so many times in my own life, where you just are focused and you don't see the larger picture. You don't see the depth of the problems, the complexities involved. It's just so much simpler to look at it with one eye. He encounters drugs when life gets too tough. He gets to the island of the Lotus Eaters, and there are drugs, and he can escape life's problems. And that is a temptation. And we have all kinds of drugs, and they're not simply the drugs that we take by mouth. They can be the consumerism that Mike talked eloquently about, the ways that we try to fill holes that can't fill the holes in our souls. And so that's an experiment that many people go through in trying to escape from the reality of their lives and their mature responsibilities. Then there are the sirens, the call of sexuality, and he is smart enough to get tied to the mast. Not everyone is. And that is a temptation and a call to him that is a universal call, and he gets past it. And then he meets Scylla and Charybdis, the grinding stones that could destroy his ship, his shipmates, his life. But grinding is interesting because it can destroy or it can take off rough edges and polish and make something not broken but better. Taking some of the edge off and making somebody whole and more perfect. And then he goes home. He's gone through his adolescence, he's gone through his experimentation, and he finds out in his odyssey, in this circular journey, that it was all about Ithaca, his wife Penelope, and his son Telemachus. And that's where home was, and that's where the journey, the Greek odyssey, brought him back. So you have a circular journey that is the journey of a person and in some ways the journey and the growth of every kind of person. Those are the issues we go through. Now let's go over to the Exodus. In the Exodus, you have the story of the Hebrew people coming out of slavery, but much more. The truths are much more important than the facts. If you look at it in terms of the images of the Exodus, here are these people living in Egypt in the West, a place of slavery, a place of death. The West is the place where the sun sets and it is dark. They are reborn out of that darkness through this wet canal into the light. It doesn't take Freud. It doesn't take Jung. It doesn't even take a translation of where that was from the Hebrew, which is Mitzrayim, which means the tight place. It's a birth story. The birth of a people, not into pure freedom, but into a life and into a journey and into a story and a saga. The Jewish story moves from the West through this birthing process into the light, across the desert. What do young people do? They rebel. What did they do in the Garden of Eden? Don't eat the fruit. The fruit looks delicious. Don't have idols. Moses turns his back. They build idols. The nature of young people is to test, is to rebel, is to find out what the consequences are of their acts and of their experimentations. So as they go across the desert, they are taken care of in the early days with manna from heaven, with various ways that they are helped and rescued. But the story doesn't end. No one who leaves Egypt lives to live peacefully in the promised land. There are lots of biblical explanations given for that. It was their sin. It was their backsliding. Those who lived in slavery could never adjust to living in freedom. But I don't think that that's it. I think that it is probably truer that it is a story and a metaphor for how we grow and what our lives are about. We are born, we are taken care of, we rebel, and then we have to find ourselves, grow up, and wander our various deserts, all the while building families, having families, nurturing a generation that will live to live in another land. And I think that it's important to remember the second river that they meet. The first river, the Red Sea, which is parted after the adventure when they get to the promised land, this new generation also goes through a parting of the waters of the Jordan. That's not in the movie. And they go through into the promised land, leaving behind the other generation. I think that's what we do. I think we are born, we are taken care of, we grow, we rebel, we try to find our lives and build our lives and make it a better world for our children when it is their turn to be born into a world and into adulthood, and they have to leave us behind. So you have the Greek journey, which is circular. You have the Hebrew journey, which is told in a linear manner from west towards a sunrise and a new land, being birthed once across the Red Sea, the next generation being rebirthed across the Jordan. And I think that these things are not accidental. Then you have the Easter story. And the Easter story is another very human story and a very human journey, but it's told on a vertical axis, from the earth towards the heavens. But the same stories and the same images. You have your 12 sons of Jacob, and you have your 12 apostles. You have Joseph thrown into the burial pit and sold for silver by his brother Judah. You have Jesus' disciples, and he is sold by Judas, the same name, the same figure, only to rise up out of the pit, Jesus at the side of God, Joseph at the side of the Pharaoh, to deliver and save his people. You have such similar stories and archetypes, and in the story of Palm Sunday and of Easter, you have these amazingly human stories. Jesus Christ Superstar. You have the idea of human beings, as Jesus was at his birth, being surrounded by humble people and by kings, being seen as a source of great hope, being honored for the potential of his young life. You have the hopes, the aspirations of his parents, at least his earthly parents, and you have his own kind of rebellion at 13 instructing his elders. That sounded pretty familiar to me, too. Most 13-year-olds do believe that they can instruct their elders. He also did stand-up, by the way. Jesus had a really wonderful line to Peter, where he said to Peter, "You are the rock upon which I will build my church." This really is a howler, since Peter, which means rock in Greek, was anything but a rock. He was jello. So this was, you know, Jesus's Lenny. So he comes to Jerusalem, and he gets the welcome, the adulation, the being raised up, and then the being rejected. It's a universal theme. Look around, read the Psalms. Look around our own world at those who we raise up and those who we tear down, and the joy that society gets in both the raising up, the adulation, and the tearing down. Look at the rhythms and the patterns of our own lives, of achievement, of vulnerability, of being struck down, and the possibilities of rebirth of our own souls. The story of the life of Jesus without the theology is a powerful story of commitment to values and of hope and of truths about how human beings are and how society is. You have a story that comes full circle in the Greek. You have a story that goes across a line in the Hebrew, and a story that goes on the vertical in its Christian version. And it's the story of every man and every woman, of birth, of hope, of achievement, of rejection, of despair, of being in a spiritual tomb and then being alive to be reborn with a sense of hope. We have winter and we have spring. We have summer and we have fall. We have birth, we have growth and maturity, we have disease, we have withering away, we have death, and we have loss. These are the cycles of life that are universal. Sometimes they turn fast, sometimes they turn slow, but they turn inevitably. And so we have pain, and most of us, even in those moments when we think we want to, wouldn't trade it. There is a line in a prayer book that I grew up with as a young boy that said, "Our grief is according to our blessing, and tears are the tender tribute of yearning affection for one who is gone but cannot be forgotten." At this season, we remember. We remember our losses, and we remember that we were blessed to be enriched by people. That as we are tied to this miracle called life, as the seasons turn in the skies, as the season turns in our hearts, as we pedal fast and slow, uphill and downhill, we are blessed that we get to do a lot of it together. That we get good company on our life's journey, and we get to look at all of the sources of wisdom from every people and every culture who tell the same story of what we can do when we are together, that helps us accept the blessings and the curses, the challenges and the joys, and sometimes to see the challenges as a source of joy. This is the strength that we give to each other when we are together and riding these wonderful, terrible, awesome cycles of life.